Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Gaining Perspective with Andrea Ruckman here on the Life Coach Radio Network of Blog Talk Radio. I'm Andrea Ruckman, your host for today, and our episode is on how people notoriously sabotage their own careers and or their companies. We're going to discuss the different ways to identify these behaviors that help people sabotage their careers or their companies, and how you can identify them in yourself in order to immediately improve the odds for success for you and or your company. I'm very honored today to have my guest, Ken Kirsch, the author of How to Kill Your Company. He is an award-winning live event producer and communications consultant. He's produced business meetings, concerts, special events for Fortune 100 companies for the past 20 years. And get this, I love this aspect of it because this is why I feel honored. He was part of the team that led the production of the torch arrival ceremonies for the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympics. Now that is really cool. I can't wait to hear a little bit more about that, and going to have to ask him some questions of what that was like. Ken has also worked closely with hundreds of C-suite executives, top university professors, best-selling business authors, whose books you've most likely have read, and with politicians around the world. In his book, How to Kill Your Company, it's basically based on his experience with such executives, employees, business owners, that has led him to the stark reality. People behave alike in ways that repeatedly hurt themselves and their companies, and that these behaviors apply to all industries, all roles, up one side of the corporate ladder and down the other. So welcome, Ken. Thank you for joining me today for our topic.
Thanks, Andrea. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So just to give our audience a little bit of an idea, in Ken's book, he covers three areas in which people kill their companies or their own careers. It's based on their personality, their relationships, and their habits. So these are are the areas we are going to focus on, and some of the topics within his book, again, How to Kill Your Company, which is available on his website at www.killyourcompany.com. So again, I'm Andrea Ruckman, your host and owner of New Perspectives Communication. And a little bit about me is I love working with organizations that are seeking to transform their reactive company culture, where their consistent urgent matters arise and frustration leads the workforce, to one that is more responsive, where leaders inspire, employees grow, and profits increase. I also like working with individuals who are looking to achieve goals they've always wanted, but need some of that accountability to help you get there. So we invite you today to call us at 646-716-9397 to talk to Ken directly about his book, his thoughts that he writes about, or anything you believe is another reason why we sabotage ourselves from success. You also have an opportunity to reach us in our chat room, but as a reminder, you need to be a member of Blog Talk Radio for that. And if you're following us at Coach Host Radio on Twitter, we are going to have our tweetable moments using hashtag Gaining Perspective, and we will share them out loud. All right, enough said. Are you ready to do this, Ken?
I am ready.
Excellent. Well, there are so many aspects of your book that I want to cover today, and it took me 2 days, literally, to narrow it down to the things that I wanted to start talking about. I'm a big fan of everything that you wrote and everything that is in this book. You have a way of getting right to the point of where people go wrong. And you hit them where it hurts, and you don't focus on what we can do to make things better. You tell them like it is, where the issues are, and how, if you do not correct it, a major snowball effect can occur. So one of the things that I love the most is your chapter 3, when you talk about put your ego in the way. So everyone lets their ego get to themselves. They are cutting people off. They're talking down to their employees. They're abrasive, insensitive, and short because they're the only one who matters. So tell me, Ken, as you experienced this in your business career, when people behave this way, what is the message that you see that they're sending to their team or to their peers?
Well, I think everyone can relate to this at least one job in their life and maybe all of the workplaces they've been. There's always somebody who's great. There's always somebody who's just okay, and there's always somebody who's being, for lack of a better term, a jerk. There's two types of egos. When we talk about putting your ego in the way, there's two types the way I look at it. The one type of person is very secure and has a big ego. The other type of person, as you can guess I'm going to say, is very insecure. So they appear to have a big ego. So they're just coming across giant when they're really feeling very small. The fact is, the enlightened leader, if you read some of Alan Watts' stuff from many years ago, there's a great wisdom in insecurity. And a lot of the great professors or business people or even just friends of yours will admit up front and readily they don't know all the answers. And, you know, we're just on this journey to, you know, deliver our service and our product and so forth. I'm not saying you need to be insecure about it. I'm just saying that you can't know everything. And I think the person that knows you have to be part of a team is the one that's the more secure one, where their ego is not going to get in the way. But specifically, I think when you sort of either condescend or cut people off or you do any of these behaviors that are just egotistical, and really what we're saying is being insensitive or disrespectful to your employees or your peers, your direct reports, whatever it might be, you're saying to this person and affect the team, because everyone hears about it, that you don't matter or you're not respected. But you're really saying, as we talked about just a few seconds ago, is that you're the one who's the jerk. This behavior, though, is often tolerated. And, you know, as a lot of people are writing and more aware of this stuff, less of it is tolerated from the leaders, and that's kind of the trend that we see happening.
And you're absolutely right, because you could see in history of different workplaces and the companies that you hear about that have issues that blow up in the media that we often see are the ones that everyone starts asking, well, how did this happen? How did it go on for so long? Who allowed this behavior and who tolerated
right.
it? And you know what? It's the aspect of those who manage upwards and not those who manage downwards. And so that is part of it. Where do you think this behavior was encouraged throughout their careers that continued to allow these individuals to act in this manner?
So my thought on that is that it probably goes back to how these people grew up and what was around them, whether they were lucky enough to have good role models or unlucky enough not to have any or to have bad ones, how secure they are as a person, lack of exposure at companies where they didn't have the chance to observe what a good leader is. I mean, you could have a person in charge of hundreds or thousands of people or running a whole business, or you could own a small restaurant. The concept is the same. If you apply that which you learned in a respectful way and be respectful to people, then you're going to get more from them instead of having people, you know, either terrified or PO'd. Where they learn it, I think they just unfortunately didn't have the right work experience.
You know, it's interesting. You said something that just moments ago where, you know, you're going to get more out of people instead of instilling fear in them. And what I see with the toleration of this behavior is that the individual who has and lets their ego get in the way, the example that they set, which is a whole other chapter of your book, the example that they're setting with the tolerance of this behavior is that instilling fear in others is appropriate. That's the way things get done. You know, if you think I have to do this or I'll lose my job. And so you see that occur too often, and you talk about the trend of organizations wanting to change that. You know,
it happens all the time.
Right, exactly. And so why do you think employees fear questioning this type of behavior? You know, they're not going to confront their boss, supervisor, leader of a company and say, you shouldn't talk to people like that. You know, where does this
fear
come from, and how do you change it?
You know, it's funny. I did some consulting for a firm about a year ago where the owner, this was a small business, was just as disrespectful as you could possibly imagine. I actually didn't think there was those types of people still in business. And as a matter of fact, after I ended my consultancy there, they wound up going out of business 6 months later. I mean, this person just wasn't doing it. But one of the people there had the audacity, the temerity to just get up, close the door and say, you can't talk to people like that. And that is the rare person, obviously, because we don't want to alienate ourselves. We don't want to lose our job. Some of us may just not have that kind of audacity in the first place. Some people seek a promotion not just for the money or the growth or the prestige. Sometimes people are looking for a promotion to get out of where they are because they don't like that kind of behavior.
And it's true because what I've found in my experience, the topic of there's more turnover in organizations basically relates to the thought that has gone on around a company. People just leave. They want more money. They don't care. But what they aren't focusing on is asking, why are you leaving? Now, I know that their companies have plenty of exit interviews, but
right,
you're not often going to hear someone open up about a former supervisor and their bad behavior because they don't want any issues should they have to ask for a reference. So again,
that's right,
the cycle just continues in these organizations where the truth never comes out. No one ever
right
addresses it, and it just, you know, elevates these types of situations. So I could see how.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I don't know that any of these behaviors are ever going to be eradicated, frankly. And, you know, the thing is to be aware of it and to deal with it. And hopefully the way this stuff gets reduced in the future is that people are a little bit more introspective about how they're being, or boards of directors work more closely with CEOs and say whether things are going well or bad, you need a business coach, or the guy asks or women ask for it themselves. In other words, I don't think we're going to lose these bad leaders or these behaviors from the workplace because of employees complaining, because they probably won't so much. But hopefully there's a more expected road ahead.
You know, and it also adds to the point of if an employee often does raise the concern of the behavior of a supervisor, how often do you see that employee being considered a troublemaker in the department?
Right.
And
exactly.
And so when that happens, no one ever addresses the situation. But when you start seeing turnover in organizations underneath an individual that has those bad behaviors.
Right. Exactly. And by the way,
that
applies. I keep saying this, but broken record here. But, you know, it's not just giant corporations. There's a lot of people out there, perhaps some of our listeners now, that manage small businesses. And whether you have one store or five stores or whatever your business happens to be, there are people that don't even realize they're sabotaging themselves because of their behavior or their lack of insight for their employees. And it's killing them. They don't even know it.
It's true. And so that brings me to my next question here. And I know it's probably the toughest one to answer because there are so many different ways, but it's a matter of people actually taking the chance. So for someone whose bad behavior is allowed, is permitted, no one questions it, what are some of the ways this behavior can be brought to, for lack of a better term, let's say, the guilty party's attention. You know, how do you stand up and say, is that who you want to be? Or for the individual that is seeing the turnover underneath them, say, I need to take a look at myself. How do they
right.
do that?
And it works in all these different ways, as you just said. I mean, this looking at this type of behavior, you're either looking in a mirror at yourself or you're looking in a magnifying glass at your employees or reports, or they're looking up at you through a magnifying glass. So there's all these different the ways that these behaviors are observed and then brought to people's attention. I can tell you this. The way to kill your company is to dance around these issues, to avoid the conflict, or if you're in a corporation, speak in vague, non-behavioral terms, or tell someone to stop being a certain way, you know, or give feedback, you know, in the context of the entire team instead of talking to that specific offender. You know, some people, to your point earlier, will tolerate what kills the productivity of others because that's just how, you know, Bob is, or that's how Sheila is, that's just how they are. Well, that's not acceptable. That's just how they are. And you also can't hope it goes away. For the most part, the people that are exhibiting the disrespect or not handling their employees the right way or not motivating people and actually being jerks is kind of where we're going with this, putting out bad behavior, is most of the time these people are aware that they're this way. They either just don't care enough or they don't have to pay a big enough price. So if this person, whether you're the leader or you're the subordinate, isn't taken to task, you got a problem. It's going to fester, it's going to get worse, and then there's world war whatever. That's how these things happen. So I guess if to reverse that, what I would say you do is you have to meet it head on. You have to be courageous. You have to be audacious. And you have to use an overused word that's under-exemplified, be accountable. You can't just be accountable for yourself. You got to be accountable for others. And I think if I had to just, you know, as I'm talking through this, to really isolate the three most important ways to deal with these behavior is with respect, with care, and directness. You know, be very direct. But there's no reason why you have to be mean about it. It's, you know, what we used to call constructive criticism.
So many people do not see criticism as constructive. And I, you know, love how you said respect, care, and direct, and that's how you have to be. You know, some of the biggest challenges is when you said that an individual doesn't care. You know, I don't care. It works for me. I get people to do what I want. And more
right.
often than not, when you see it hits them the hardest is when all of a sudden they're at the subject of a lawsuit. For their behavior, hostile work environment, discrimination, you know, harassment, any of those types of issues. And the one thing that unfortunately you don't see as a protected class in the legal realm is those who are bullies. And you often find that with those who have this ego, I often see that they always have to be right about a situation. So
right.
how much, in your opinion, how much does the need to be right at all costs encourage this behavior?
Well, that really goes to the core of all 50 chapters right there. It's also obviously has a lot to do with ego. Listen, I don't know anyone who likes to be wrong, right? So like all the instincts and behaviors in the book, we're all guilty of some of them to some extent. Needing to be right, like any of these behaviors, like hogging the credit, chapter 4, I think it is natural. Just for many people, it just goes too far. So if you're a leader, you know, if you're a real leader, like a good leader, do you really care who's right as long as the job gets done? Do you need to be right? Does this one need to be right? You know, so I would say here, replace the need to be right with, you know, just the need to succeed. If success is happening, you know, stop being right all the time. And by the way, there's nothing the matter with being right. It's just when it gets past the point, like everything else, sometimes the enemy is you.
You know, I love that. And what I often find is that even in situations where you are not right, but you drive the point home, what is the example you're setting? And again, I know this hits another chapter in your book, and our listeners can really understand I'm going to hit so many points from other different chapters that it's just one of those things that it's great for you to think about. What are you doing? Are you guilty of a behavior or not guilty of a behavior? And so when you have this moment and you drill it and you drill it, and this example that you're setting, you're a leader of an organization, people report into you. That example that you're setting is one that shows that regardless of how right or wrong you are, or even when you're wrong, you just keep driving your point until others believe you. Now, the question is, are you drinking the Kool-Aid yourself? Because if you can see to the point that you're wrong, why not give up? Why don't people let it go?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I can say that I think as you get older as a person and in business, you get mature and you learn to realize what's right, what's not, what's important, what isn't. You know, it's helpful to know, for example, whether you or your report's operating systems are, you know, introverted or extroverted, if you're a sensor, intuitor, thinker, feeler, and all that Myers-Briggs stuff, which is great. But it's also helpful to know what you and your report's strengths and weaknesses are in terms of the personality, relationships, and habits. You know, nothing I've done in the book is an accident, including reducing the word count as much as possible. But these traits, over time, if you check guilty today, it might not be guilty tomorrow. And part of my reason for writing this book, in the form of a self-assessment, pretty much, right to the point, you can read it in 90 minutes, and if you can't, you probably should see me after class. But the point is, part of my reason for writing this goes to the very core of human behavior, is that these are soft targets or soft, I forget what the expression is in the sort of management community, but they're soft items like motivation and behavior as opposed to the quantifiable, you know, numbers and so forth. But the way I see it, the soft targets are the most vulnerable. And if you don't give care and attention to all these different behaviors, you're going to lose.
Yeah, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. One of my favorite sayings, and I don't remember if I heard it, I know I read it in somewhere or heard it somewhere, is that hard skills are hard, and soft skills may be soft, but soft skills are definitely harder than hard, because it really is about your attitude and your behavior and your choice of what you're going to do. And so what have you seen in your experience? And I want to leave this chapter and move on to others, but I want to leave it in this question for you to answer. What are the steps that true effective leaders who are going to be successful, what steps do they take to make this change in such behaviors, this behavior?
Well, I guess I would answer that two ways. The first one is so simple, Andrea, you might not even like it, and that is to pay attention. One of our consultants, Michael Weber, coaches people individually, some of whom are quite well known on this and in groups. And there are ways to pick up on cues and information that offer free, immediate, useful information where you can catch yourself and others in the midst of these behaviors. You know, most of us have our heads down, which in general is good, but if your head's down like everyone's is buried in their phones these days, instead of taking an empathic view of others and studying your own behavior and theirs, you know, you're going to miss it. You're going to miss something. It's not enough to know that you did something that could have been better. You need to know why you thought this way or acted that way. The second answer, which is also simple, is sort of the three steps I outlined toward the end of the book, which is you have to identify these, what I call intrusions. So if these behaviors are instincts, you're doing great, everything's fine, great, rock and roll, move on. But some of them are not. and I just refer to them as intrusions, like reaching for that second cookie. You know, one's fine. Two, you know, maybe you want it, maybe you don't, but you have to be aware of it. And the second thing is to retrain your instincts. And third would be just to read more, to share more, and to persist, taking together what I would call mind surgery. So if you don't know what's wrong, you can't fix it. If you don't contemplate it or address it or plan to modify it, whether it's you or your team or one person, it won't get fixed. But if you do, you got a good shot at it. So I would say pay attention is the best way to recognize these behaviors. All you have to do is like look up and pay attention. It's almost that simple. And the other way would be to just really be keeping track of these. I mean, frankly, I keep this book handy myself because I'm guilty of four things in here in particular that I'm always working on, and it's like a handy reference to me that reminds me what I need to work on. And sometimes these things move around and migrate. But, you know, the goal is not to be perfect. We're all a work in progress. Companies are a work in progress. And like the money slide from my PowerPoint presentation, in which there are very few slides and very few words on them, is on my Twitter account, which is growth is uncomfortable, so is the truth. So once you grasp that, you can move on and you can do better things for yourself and your company.
I love that. Growth is uncomfortable, so is the truth. That's definitely going to be what I call one of our tweetable moments here. You know, one of the things that you mentioned here about paying attention, pay attention to how you act and how you are and where are you in different situations, is one of my most favorite areas of personal development. How mindful are you in any given situation? How mindful are you of the people that are around you? How mindful are you of the words that are coming out of your mouth, the impact right. that it has, the results that it drives, how it drives those results? How are people viewing you? Do you see other people's body language, their looks? Are they looking down and feeling beaten upon, or are they looking at you feeling invigorated, energized, and ready to go forth with the task at hand and really want to do what's ahead of them as a task? Are you an individual that I want to work for? Are you holding yourself accountable the same way you're holding me accountable? So all these different areas that you talk about, and this is one of the many reasons of why I enjoy this book so much, because it really hits home with me and my focus when I work with people as individuals or organizations as it relates to their culture. If the behavior of an ego is allowed to continue and you see the turnover underneath an individual and people don't believe in what they're saying because it's all about me, you know, the generation of me, you know, we hear that constantly, even about the younger generation coming in. They only focus on themselves, what they could do, how people can hear they're selfish.
Mm-hmm.
But I have
mm-hmm.
to say, you'll see that in every single generation, and whether it be in a workplace that you've been in or out in public or at a social event, you'll find the person that has the ego, the person that will dominate the conversation, the individual that will try to make you feel small for your thoughts. And you know what the number one conversation about politics that everyone loves to fight about, but they're not open to hear what others say because their own ego gets in the way.
Right.
And so as I was going through this and trying to decide where do I want to start discussing with you about this whole ego concept and all the other areas, and I'm telling our listeners, this: you want to get this book because it's not just about how you kill your company or damage your career. It is about you as an individual and how you behave in all aspects of your life. I don't care what the title is of the book, you will find yourself guilty of some behavior in some way, shape, or form of your book. And that's just my take of it because, yes, maybe reading it an hour and a half is if you go through it quickly and only think about it as someone who owns a company. But I will tell you, Ken, it took me a little bit longer than an hour and a half because each time I read a chapter, I decided to sit there and kind of create a list, I will say, whether it be about my company, my current or past behaviors in workplace, and how am I in my personal life. And I thought it was so wonderful because even though I could say, you know, that's not how I am here, but then it would show up in a personal aspect, I would see how does that intertwine in other areas and do I behave a certain way. And so what I often find is that no matter when people say, oh, I'm one person in the workplace and I'm another one at home, I will disagree with anybody 100%. So take the time, read the book, see how you are professionally and personally. And if you think you're better in one area than the other, start thinking of very specific scenarios. Not the good ones, well, not just the good ones, but also in the bad ones, but not just the bad ones, also in the good ones, because you will find something minor that you could always change in there. Okay. So
I love that perspective. I really do. And what you're saying that resonates is we're really talking about human behavior here. So whether you're going to be a human, whether you're home or whether you're work, and it's all how you want to put yourself out there.
Absolutely. And so that's why I thank you so much for, you know, meeting you. It was just great. And being able to read this book, it was really wonderful to give me a very different perspective on not just one thing, but in many different ways. So,
awesome.
And hopefully for our listeners, it's doing the same for you. And I just want to remind you that you could call in and share your thoughts, challenge our thoughts, you know, whatever it is that's on your mind, please give us a call at 646-716-9397. And you could also follow us on Twitter at Coach Host Radio, hashtag Gaining Perspective of anything you want to throw out there as ideas or thoughts or something that just hit you. And if you are a Blog Talk Radio member, feel free to reach us in our chat room to share some thoughts. And before we go on to our next subject, because I think with the ego, we've really hit that, and before we hit the next chapter that I thought was really a great topic, I just want to talk to our listeners about some of the shows that are coming up on Life Coach Radio Network here on Blog Talk Radio. So tomorrow, September 27th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time, How to Set Boundaries. And that's something that's also probably would be a great topic in here as well, and that is kind of in there. You have to set your boundaries of what you can do and what you can't do. So if you're not good at that, add it to a leadership skill and tune in tomorrow at 12 o'clock. On Monday, September 30th at 8 p.m., Spiritual Practice of Gratitude on Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen Kotler. Being gracious and thankful for the things that you have, you're not entitled to anything. Another chapter in this book about feeling entitled. So all these little different things that I'm reading on here as our upcoming shows are different topics in your book. So it's great. It works out well. Except for maybe
I just want to say one thing. You say, like, how can you change these behaviors, how you notice them and change them and so forth. You know, each one of these chapters, I admit, I'm touching on it. There are books and books and great sources of information on the net, in the bookstore, you know, amongst your friends, where you can really explore any of these topics in much more depth. My goal is to just shine a light on these 50 discrete traits or instincts or behaviors, and then, you know, you go from there. Because you may not need 47, you might need 7.
And that's absolutely right. I agree wholeheartedly with you. And sometimes something may pop up in your life somewhere that you don't even realize is actually effective in here. And this is a good step. This is what I'm doing wrong. Now what type of – now where should I go? Now what? How do I get to the next step? And I'm so glad that you shared that with everybody as we continue on to this. And I can't wait to hear some more of the great things that you have to share as your thought process went in on this. Just two last things that I just want to share with our audience. About Tuesday, October 1st at 8 p.m., Danielle Mercurio of New City U Coaching, she's talking about Upbeat, the power of music and positivity. Positivity is a huge factor in making people excited, creating energy, sharing communication, and getting people motivated. So that's one last thing that I want to share. And, of course, the next episode of Gaining Perspective will be on October 10th with my guest, Cheryl Ellis, the founder of Ellis Business Enterprises, where we're going to discuss how to lead from within. So it's a great follow-up to our conversation today that I'm having here with Ken Kirsch of How to Kill Your Company, as we talk about the different ways you could move forward. And a lot of the topics we're discussing, read the book, tune in next time, and we'll have a great opportunity to discuss about those inner qualities to make some change. So what the perfect segue to the next chapter I want to talk about, which is your chapter 14, Resistant to Change and Opportunity. When you stop changing, you stop evolving. I love that. It's like you, if you stop growing, then there's no other thing to do except for die. So, Ken, share with the audience exactly what makes people resistant to change.
Well, I would say in general that we're wired that way. I mean, just like conversely, some of the good things we're wired for is that we respond to story or we respond to music. But I don't think we're inherently drawn to change. And maybe that goes back to the cavemen and all that other stuff. But, you know, if the food's over there, that's where you go. It worked. You know, and many people have written about change, volumes of it. If it's working, you know, why change it? But more specifically, I guess I would say that a good reason we resist change is to be efficient. And if you're an employee or you're a direct report or if you're even a leader, and this is a conceptual thing we're talking about, a process as opposed to a task, let's say, strategy as opposed to tactics and so on, you know, if it's working, we tend to want to keep doing it. So in general, that's a good reason that we resist change because we're being rewarded for doing things right. A bad reason might be indolence or ignorance. I can't imagine how being lazy or not thinking or knowing can be helpful. There's ignorance is bliss, but that's a whole other topic. But maybe what makes people resistant to change is just that that's their habit. And I think like everything else we talked about here, you have to be ever aware and vigilant. And it's all behaviors, not just change. You know, artists fight this all the time. They just do it more actively. So, you know, if whether you're an actor or a songwriter, musician, whatever kind of artist you might be, these people's mentality is, I don't want to do the same thing I did already. That's why you might not like the third album because you like the second album and you might not like this growth or that growth. But then if you wait a while and you like their intent, it'll come back and you'll find another way to enjoy whatever they're doing. But business people should fight the instinct to keep doing the same thing too. I don't mean throwing out everything and changing everything. I obviously just mean contemplate. For the artist, it's easier because they're one person and their drive for growth and self-expression is so intrinsic and easier to facilitate and control. But for a CEO or a manager or an owner, an employee, it's all about being efficient. So you have to be careful that you're doing the right thing, but you also have to look out for opportunity.
Yeah, it's funny. In the simplest form of the resistance to change, I was actually having a conversation with someone the other day, and they were talking about how their company moved from one system to another, and she's been battling wanting to accept it because she's so used to what is already in existence and that she's been fighting it. And she goes, I know at some point in time I'm not going to be able to fight this any longer, and I'm sure if I just took the time, it would be just as easy as this was. But I hate dealing with change.
Right.
So I think
the word there is denial, right? It's like you're going to have to get there. You might as well get there now. And, yeah, it's not easy, but you push yourself. And once you reacclimate yourself to a new process, you know what? The next time the process changes, it's not going to be so hard. And that's like when you talk about culture, when you do your consulting work, it's all about a culture of change and being proactive. So you don't want to just, you get my point.
I do. You know the, and even funnier.
I was going to go off on a tangent, but I restrained myself.
Ah, see, you changed. That's excellent. And held your ego in check. No, I'm just kidding. Everything that you've been sharing has been dead on and very useful for our listeners. You know, even when it comes to change, I laugh that, do you still see people out, you know, exercising, riding a bike or running, and they still have a Walkman in their hand?
Mm-hmm.
Or
nice.
A CD player. Like I joke and say, wow. But I remember when MP3 players first came out, I was like, well, what is that going to do? And it took a while. Same thing with changing from a regular phone to a smartphone. It seems so complicated.
Well, and how about CDs? I mean, you know, who buys CDs anymore?
And there are some people that don't even know what that is.
Right.
There was one of those celebrity interviews, and Ethan Hawke was talking about this. It's a movie that he's on with Selena Gomez, and he made a comment of, oh, she's going to make me a mixtape. And he goes, oh, my God, I don't even think she's old enough to know what a mixtape is.
That's pretty funny.
And so what I find, it actually brings me to a point, and I'm going to kind of just ask you for your thoughts on this aspect. When it comes to those who are resistant to change, how much of the generational gap do you think plays a role into this? Let's talk about baby boomers versus millennials in the workforce right now.
Well, my take on that is that it's, on one hand, it's generic and it's universal and it applies to everybody. When you get into more specifics, I think it becomes very generational, as you're alluding to, when it has to do with, you know, people over 40 and under 40 in general have a very different take, and then people under 30 and over 30. So there's all these different levels of generations of companies. I think in general terms, you know, work is work and people are people, but if you're going to talk about a certain type of technology, to state an obvious example, because I'm really good at those, I think that the older people will have more trouble in general than the younger people, because the younger people grew up digital and they don't know anything else, or they don't know it as difficult, is what I mean to say.
Yeah. When I think in the company sense-wise, one of the most current topics that everyone loves to make a joke about, and it's kind of sad. It's like one of the things in your book, you talk about the established way of doing is ideal only until someone creates a better one. And one of the best examples I currently have out there is BlackBerry. And
right.
The way how effective it is in the current topic of events going on in today's society, they can't keep up. They're still sticking with a certain type of programming that they do. And, you know, RIM, I think they just went back to being a private company. So
right.
Using that experience of an organization, you know, share some thoughts of how ideals are no longer ideal.
Right. So you mentioned BlackBerry, which is the perfect, most timely example of it, a company not being proactive or not changing or allowing other companies to change. Their shares are down. T-Mobile stopped stocking its phones. You know, Apple's interface. And I guess it was, if I recall correctly, it was more about Steve Jobs' desire to not build the best computer when they started, but build the best way to improve people's lives. So he's coming at this gestalt, if I can use that word, of people's lives, not just, you know, what item we're going to sell. And I think these companies get too into their product sometimes, and they don't see the forest for the trees. And it's like, well, you know what? Maybe if BlackBerry took a wider view, they wouldn't be in the pickle they're in. But then again, they could recover. Who knows? It's, you know, it's not like they're out of business, it's just they're having problems. But it does appear like they've missed the boat of change. An example of an industry, another obvious one, is record companies. And again, Apple's is involved because, you know, one of the reasons Apple's stock price is close to 500 and it's number one by market cap, is it really is a very empathic company. They understand people. You know, if people knew people as well as Apple knew people, I think we'd have better workplaces and more productive people. But the record companies, they were fat, dumb, and happy and resistant to change. And in effect, Apple didn't just steal their business. It stole the industry. Even the name record company is an anachronism. As we said, you know, a minute ago, very few people even buy CDs anymore. But they refused to change. They, more to the point, they refused to lead change. So here they are playing follow-up and catch-up, and that whole industry is just, you know, in complete transition, overtaken by other companies that created change. They could have done this themselves or partnered in it earlier on. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, by the way, to paraphrase the Serenity Prayer, I believe it's called, is the wisdom to know the difference in what you can and what you can't change. Sometimes knowing what you shouldn't change is the right approach. You know, the opposite of what we're talking about. Restaurants do this really well. I was at a place last night that had, just like any other restaurant, their regular dishes and their specials. And their specials are great, and the regular dishes are great. But you don't want to mess with the regular dishes because people are depending on that. And the obvious example there is Coke. By changing their formula, which they should have done, they turned off a lot of people and they had to recover, which they did quite well, obviously. I think that's chapter 46, recover. You failed to recover.
No, you're right. I remember that whole episode with Coke and they tried a new formula and they failed. And I think Burger King was another one with their French fries. They went to try this whole new method
right.
with their French fries, and that was an epic fail for them as well. It's
right.
Really
somebody must
true.
Have told you about that because I know you don't eat them, so.
Yeah. It used to be a guilty pleasure. You know, once in a while you just get that salt craving.
There you go.
But, you know, and with this whole thing about this change of knowing when to change, when not to change, how much do you think the fear of the unknown plays into the reluctancy to change?
Well, I think you hit it. I think it's everything. And to put it in a nutshell, to answer that big question with a small answer, I'd say it's why we leave so much on the table as individuals and as companies. Because it's that unknown thing, and we don't do something or we don't try something, and there's all this fun, money, pride, wealth, growth that we leave on the table, and the great crime is that we don't even know that we're doing that. We don't even know that we miss those opportunities. It's one thing to recognize an opportunity and say, no, I'm not going to do that because of this and such. Whether you're right or wrong, you knew it. But if you're ignorant or if you don't pay attention, then you're going to leave stuff on the table, and that fear of the unknown or anxiety about looking into the center of the target is going to just kill your chances and kill your company, to use a phrase.
Yeah, and I will take this aspect and I will put it into more of for people in their personal lives. You know, the fear of the unknown is, I think, more the reasons why we're held back from individual successes, because if everybody had a crystal ball and they know how the outcome would be, they jump at every chance to do something for themselves. You know, for me as an individual to decide to go out on my own and start a business was not about the fear of what might not happen, but it was more of my fear of if in 10 years I look back and say, I should have, I could have, if I had, I would have. And that was my fear of the unknown of feeling that way in the beginning. It made me say that I am going to take this chance, and I personally don't care if it works or doesn't work because I don't know what it's going to be. And even if it is something that doesn't work out, boy, have you learned an incredible lesson of what not to do going forward. So I
right.
think when people hold themselves back from success, potential success, or failure, they lose such an incredible learning experience that they cut their nose to spite their face, to use, you know, silly different type of situation.
Well, and what you're enhancing the point about growth being uncomfortable, because for me, I can't speak for everybody, but for me, if I'm not comfortable with something, and I don't mean for good reason, but I'm just like anxious about it, or I don't understand it, or I'm uncomfortable about it, I probably will lean in towards doing it because I know that growth is uncomfortable. And if it's easy, I'm not going to get any better, and the clock is ticking. If it's difficult or it's uncomfortable, there might be a reason why I need to do it. And I'm not saying I just jump off of airplanes, you know, like take silly chances or do things whimsically like that. But, you know, it maybe if you're fearful about something, that's exactly why you should do it.
Stare fear right in the face.
There you go.
Yeah. You know, speaking of clock ticking, we only have a few minutes left of our show today, and there's one more chapter to me that I wanted to save this as the last, because this is so relevant that people get confused. Why don't they get it? You know, and they're
right.
Too often people who are more inwardly focused and drive their own opinion in a way that confuses so many others, they lack the ability to communicate in a multitude of ways and just expect others to just get it because that's the way they get it. So chapter
right.
27, you don't know your audience. So this is great because it's one of the primary things that I see fail in communication in organizations. So what do you see, Ken, as the cause of people that are stuck in one form of communicating as with only the way that they receive? So how do they learn to change that? Because they can't recognize it.
So I think that one area that we see this a lot today that people talk about, whether it's business people, comedians, or online magazine articles, is emailing and texting. And people are leaning on that because it's really efficient and easy. I have another chapter on that that says you email too much, and that's one of the things I'm guilty of. But the point is, you have to develop a communication culture such that people are not afraid to use the sneaker net, you know, to get up and go over to John and say, hey, listen, I was working this thing. I'm not sure what you meant by this, but this is so important. I got to tell you in person. Or pick up the phone. I like to say every 10 phone calls, pick up the phone. Just make the call. And you want to focus more, in this case, on empathy, which you talk a lot about, precision, respect, and the way I look at it is if the whole world is watching. You want to think as when you're going to communicate something, unless it's just so incidental and perfunctory that it's not that meaningful, but you want to communicate. You want to think first, what's the best way I can communicate whatever it is I have to do? Do you need to convince somebody? Do you need to inform somebody? And so forth. One of the things I try to do with the book and in my life is cut out all the clutter, cut out anything extra. What I see in websites and I see in books and I see in people's conversations and I see in emails is too much, too many words. Cut out the ones you don't need. It's easier for people to get, if you're talking about email and texting and memos and that sort of thing now, be very precise, respectful, understand who it is you're writing to this letter to, because it's going to be different from that one, and, you know, be to the point, obviously. But I think the culture of communication starts at the top, and whether it's the CEO or the HR that leads it, it's something you have to focus on.
Yeah, and I love that you say that where it says, you know, cut out the clutter. Learn the best way that to communicate to others. But the problem becomes, and I've often heard people say this and they challenge it, I don't need to learn 15 different ways to communicate to people. I don't have time to communicate 15 different ways. Now, when you end up with someone that is, again, resistant to that kind of change, what would you suggest is the way to go about the understanding how others receive the important information and what are the values to them to receive that?
So in terms of if you're a leader or a manager and you want your people to know that, or what do you mean? Maybe you could rephrase that for me.
Exactly as you just said it. So I have a team of six people, and there are six mm-hmm. different ways they receive information. How do I do it without feeling like I have to send a message six different times?
Right. I think it comes back to the communication culture, and I think it's going to be you have a way of doing business. If it's XYZ types of communications, email them. If it's ABC types of communications, you pick up the phone or you go see them or you arrange for an appointment. Because, you know, overlooking, as I was saying, the important cues that you would see in person that you're not going to get are what cause a lot of problems. I think you need to be intelligent, aware. I think you need to, as a manager of these people or leader of a much bigger division, I think training is important. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a four-week course in how to communicate. Just, I think it comes back to being a good leader and just saying, this is how we're going to get things done. If anybody's got a better idea, great, but we need to communicate this way.
And with that communication, I'm going to end our conversation on some of these topics. We could go on forever because, again, like I said, This was an incredible conversation, and Ken, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to discuss your book, How to Kill Your Company. And speaking of that, do me a favor, Ken. Can you just sum up in a few words, few sentences, your final thoughts on the things that we've talked about and highlight some of the great points? Because I know our listeners would definitely want to grab your book. So also share with them how they can get in touch with you, where they can get your book, and so on and so on.
Thank you. So the book is How to Kill Your Company, 50 Ways You're Bleeding Your Organization and Damaging Your Career. It's available on Amazon. You can look for it that way. Another easy way to go is kenkirsch.com, which is K-E-N-K-I-R-S-H, kenkirsch.com, or howtokillyourcompany.com. Also on Twitter at Ken Kirsch, K-E-N-K-I-R-S-H. And you can get the book in an ebook form or paperback, whatever you wish, on Amazon or iTunes or Kindle and Barnes & Noble. I think the way I would close our talk today is the same way that I close my workshops, which is with two thoughts. One is that it's not about being perfect. It's about being better. And it's not about later. It's about now. I don't mean that to sound motivational. I just mean it to sound focusing. Yes, growth is uncomfortable, but you know what? If you go through my book and you check the guilties and not guilties, you're probably going to find that 40 out of 50 or more are spot on. Well, guess what? That's positive reinforcement, and you should be happy about that. And then you just kind of work on the other things. You don't have to be perfect, but you got to get on it. And if you want a good team and a successful company, you got to look at the other people and manage their behaviors too.
That's great. Thank you again so much for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time out to join me on Gaining Perspective today. And for our listeners, I hope that you found our conversation today engaging, enlightening, and are now focused on a path to getting to where you want to be in your career or business ownership. If you have any ideas or suggestions that you would like to hear on Gaining Perspective on Life Coach Radio Network, you could find us at lifecoachradionetworks.com, and you could send us a message directly there. And also, if you love listening to Life Coach Radio Network, you can now tune in to Life Coach TV Network on YouTube. Later today, I'll be sending out my next iteration of Gaining Perspective in video format. So some of your favorite radio hosts are also now on the video network of YouTube. That's Life Coach TV Networks, and you could find us right on YouTube. If you also want to see anything, you could find us at lifecoachtvnetworks@gmail.com. So again, thank you, Ken, for being here and everybody for listening. We look forward to you again, as I said, next month. on October, what did I say? On October 10th with my guest, Cheryl Ellis, the founder of Ellis Business Enterprises, as we talk about the next steps to follow on to How to Kill Your Company, as we talk about learning to lead from within. So life is short. You only get one shot at it. Make sure you're enjoying all of it, your time, and your experiences in it. Until next time, thank you and have a great day.